From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, cloning. We'll talk with NPR science correspondent Joe Palca. Yesterday, he broke the story that an American scientist plans on opening a clinic to clone humans. We'll also talk about the scientific principles behind cloning and the ethical debate around it with Gina Collada, a New York Times science reporter who has written a new book called Clone, The Road to Dolly and the Path Ahead. Also today, one of the most influential drummers in the history of jazz, Elvin Jones. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Convicted conspirator Terry Nichols won't face the death penalty in connection with the Oklahoma City bombing. The jury considering his penalty deadlocked, and Judge Richard Mache has dismissed the panel. Mache will decide Nichols' sentence, but he cannot, by law, hand down the death penalty. NPR's Wade Goodwin has been following the trial. He says the jury had to decide whether Nichols deserved death for his actions.
The issue the jury had before them was to decide whether Terry Nichols actually intended to kill the people inside the Murrah Federal Building. Without that intent to kill, they could not sentence him to death. And although they believed the government had proved to them beyond a reasonable doubt that Terry Nichols had conspired to build the bomb and to use the bomb, they did not feel that the government had proved to them that he intended to use the bomb against the Murrah Federal Building and to kill those people inside of it.
The Associated Press quotes Judge Mache saying that he would issue a penalty of less than life in prison if the jurors deadlocked. A California biotechnology firm will plead guilty to conspiring with an unnamed tobacco company to grow tobacco with a high nicotine content. The plea agreement is the first under the Justice Department's investigation of the tobacco industry. The criminal information was filed against DNA Plant Technology Corporation of Oakland. The government says the tobacco company is an unindicted co-conspirator but will not identify it in court papers. High nicotine tobacco growing is banned in this country. The government alleges the tobacco company's goal was to develop a good source of high-nicotine tobacco it could use to control and change nicotine levels of cigarettes. Scientists are responding to Dr. Richard See, the physicist who wants to clone human beings. Several scientists are expressing opposition to the idea. Professor Art Kaplan is with the University of Pennsylvania's Center for Bioethics. He says science really hasn't gotten to the point where human cloning can occur. Further, Kaplan says such cloning would be irresponsible and unethical for safety reasons.
I don't think we'll see human cloning anytime in the next 3 to 5 years. And I would say, furthermore, I think we should pass a law in this country, as the state of California has, as the British have, as the French have, as the Germans have, that puts a moratorium in place right now on human cloning. Just strictly on safety grounds alone, putting the ethics aside, it would be absolutely immoral to try and clone someone right now, given the primitive state of the technology, given the primitive state of knowledge about how it works.
Professor Art Kaplan of the University of Pennsylvania's Center for Bioethics. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 81.5 points at 7,824. Trading is heavy on volume of 283 million shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index is off nearly 22 points at 1558. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is lower for the second day on concern about corporate earnings. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
The market's drop is being led by high technology issues, which fell when Atmel Corporation warned of a fourth quarter loss. The semiconductor maker says some of its Asian customers haven't been able to finance their purchases. Another negative is weakness in the dollar, which fell against the yen for the first time in a week. That occurred on speculation that U.S. and Japanese officials meeting today in Washington may take steps to curb the dollar's strength. In turn, the weaker dollar has forced long-term interest rates higher. Also arguing in favor of higher rates is word that new home sales jumped by a stronger-than-expected 5.1% during November. I'm Doug Krisner.
President Clinton is unveiling a new plan today that will make 2 million children eligible for child care financial aid. The program is to be up and running during the next 5 years. President Clinton will announce the grants and tax breaks worth $21 billion to help make child care more affordable, he says, for working families. A business research firm reports fewer people got pink slips last year, but challenger Gray & Christmas reports that the number of layoffs picked up speed at the end of 1997. Still, the firm reports job cuts dropped 9% from the number of cuts reported in 1996. Iraq's oil minister says Baghdad will resume oil exports this weekend under the United Nations Oil for Food program. The UN approved Baghdad's plan yesterday to distribute humanitarian supplies that were bought with oil money. Again on Wall Street, the Dow was off 81.5 points. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 200 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Less than 1 year after a baby sheep was cloned from an adult sheep, a scientist in Chicago named Richard Seed has announced that he plans on opening a clinic in the next 90 days to clone human babies. Seed is a physicist who was involved with fertility research in the 80s. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Gina Collada, a New York Times science reporter, who has written a new book about the history, science, and ethics of cloning. First, we have NPR science correspondent Joe Palca with us. Yesterday, he broke the story about the planned human cloning clinic. What does Richard Seed want to do at his clinic?
Well, he wants to provide this as an alternative to infertile couples who want to have babies. And he's described certain scenarios where cloning would be a couple's only option. For example, if a man can produce no sperm at all and he wanted to have a genetic offspring related to him, he would have to give some of his DNA from not a sperm, and that would essentially be cloning him by putting it into presumably his wife's egg, which had its DNA removed.
This fellow sounds pretty confident that he's ready to begin human cloning, but what are some of the scientific obstacles he has to overcome in order to actually do it?
Well, they're really enormous. I mean, the Scottish scientist who succeeded with cloning Dolly only succeeded after more than 200 attempts. So to say that he's confident is more than anybody in the world says about trying this in any animal. Sheep, where it's been done, there have been reports that I've talked with people who've said they've tried it in cattle, and there may, in fact, be some pregnancies now from this same technique, but only like a handful. And so to say, well, I'm going to take this technology, which hasn't been proven in animals and never attempted in humans, and I'm going to try it, and I think it's going to be at least as successful as current in vitro fertilization techniques is pretty wishful thinking, I think.
Can he legally start cloning humans in Chicago?
Well, in one sense, he can. Right now, there's a federal prohibition on spending any federal money on cloning. So if you're a private citizen and you want to spend money on cloning, that's okay. There is one state that I know of, California, that has passed a law that makes cloning illegal. So you can't clone in California, cloning human beings. So in principle, he could try. But now the Food and Drug Administration has said, well, you're going to be manipulating cells and tissue in the body and putting it back into people, and we've decided we have jurisdiction over that kind of thing. So in theory, at least, although they haven't seen the details of what Dr. Seed is proposing, they would have authority to look at his plans and approve or reject them.
What is the ethical debate surrounding his proposal?
Well, I think it goes back to the question of when is it appropriate to try this. There's a larger debate about whether anybody should do this ever, right? And there are some people who say, no, cloning is beyond what we were intended to do. And there are other people who say, yes, cloning is not that different than other kinds of assisted reproduction. So that's the big debate, and that's still an open question. But the debate about whether it's ethical to try today when you haven't finished proving that it works in animals, it seems to be clearer, and most people seem to think it's unethical to do today.
Joe, in your report on Richard Seed, he said that he thinks human cloning will bring us closer to God because God made man in God's image, and now if man makes man in his own image, that's going to bring him closer to God. And I wonder what kind of reaction that comment has gotten, if you know.
Well, just judging by the people around here that have heard it and I've talked to have heard it, it's one of those comments that encompasses a great deal. And it's so huge in its philosophy that it's a little hard to know how to judge it. It gives almost a messianic quality to his interest in this, which makes some people uncomfortable. I think you have to realize that this is not a man in the mainstream. He's a bit of a fringe player, and he's a big thinker. And clearly he's seeing this as a calling in some way, and that makes people uncomfortable. That doesn't make him wrong or doesn't mean he can't do it, but it certainly makes a lot of people uncomfortable.
Do you expect anyone is going to try to prevent him from setting up the clinic in Chicago?
Yes. I think that the notoriety that has already begun to occur now that his story has been, you know, been out on the national media and picked up in several other news organizations is going to focus a very sharp, very bright spotlight on him. And I think that, you know, the president was very clear, President Clinton, back in June when he said, I'm asking the private sector not to do this, and I'm prohibiting the federal government from spending money on it. I think it would be very hard for someone to proceed in that climate in such a public way.
Well, Joe, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're most welcome.
Joe Palca is NPR science correspondent. A new book called Clone looks at the scientific breakthroughs that made Dolly, the cloned sheep, possible. The book also examines the ethical debate around cloning. Yesterday, I spoke with the author Gina Collada, who's a science reporter for The New York Times. I asked her first to describe the basic concept of cloning.
The idea of cloning is to take the genetic material from a cell, and let's say it's an adult skin cell, for example. You take the genetic material from a skin cell and you use that to create an entire new organism that will be born as the identical twin of the person or animal or whatever that gave you that skin cell. It's kind of an amazing concept because it's saying that you can take the genes from a cell which has already had its fate determined, take them all the way back to the state they were at when sperm first fertilized egg, and create a new being from those genes. It's amazing, really.
The most famous cloned organism is Dolly the sheep, and she was cloned from the cell of an adult sheep. What was so remarkable about the case of Dolly?
There are a couple of things that were remarkable. First of all, these were cells from udder cells from a sheep that was long dead, and the udder cells had remained frozen in a test tube in a freezer for 3 years. What was absolutely amazing about this is many people had thought that this was impossible, that once a cell has reached its final destination, its final fate, you can't turn the clock backwards. For example, a brain cell never becomes a liver cell, a lung cell never becomes a kidney cell. So why would we think that a cell taken from an udder of a sheep could become an embryo, the very earliest embryo, and develop from there into a newborn baby, which is the genetic identical twin of that sheep who's dead, whose udder cells are remaining in the freezer?
Now, let me stop you right here and make sure I understand. An embryo cell, the cells haven't differentiated yet into heart tissue and lung tissue and facial tissue, whereas once you take the cell from an adult, it's already differentiated. It's become the tissue of a particular organ.
That's right. And people had thought that once you reach that state, that final state of a cell, that something has changed and you can't take the genes backwards again to what they had once been.
But this is what the scientists who made Dolly were able to do.
That is exactly what they did. They were able to take those genes and make them into every cell of a new organism because Dolly was a newborn sheep that had exactly the same genes as that other sheep who was already dead.
Now, how did the scientists do it? How did they take this cell from the udder of an adult sheep and clone it?
Well, all the work was done by the egg, which is what makes this really remarkable. The egg is really the cell that does what scientists can't do. What the scientists did was they took an egg from a sheep that was not related to Dolly, just a sheep of a totally different species, and took the genetic material, the DNA, out of that egg Then they added into the egg the DNA from the udder cell. And the way they did that is not as important as the fact that they just added in new DNA into an egg. And the egg reversed the genetic program so that it was no longer DNA that was only going to make new udder cells, and turned it back so that it was DNA that could create a whole new sheep.
What are the implications of this?
Well, the thing that makes scientists so excited about this is the idea that if you can allow an egg to bring the DNA of a developed cell, a differentiated cell, back to ground zero, back to where it started from again, then why would you have to have that new thing develop into a whole new organism? Why couldn't you force it to develop into whatever you want? For example, a new bone marrow only, just bone marrow. Or perhaps in the future sometime, a new heart or a new liver or new lungs. In fact, that's why scientists have been so concerned that we not act too quickly in trying to ban cloning, because they say what's going to really change our lives is not cloning new human beings, which, although I think it's going to happen, it will probably happen very rarely and for very special reasons, but actually thinking of, like, when you're 60 years old and your heart is giving out, taking some cells escaping from your mouth, taking those cells, putting them into an egg or whatever we end up doing in these days in the future, and then letting that new cell grow into a new heart for you, or a new liver, or a new bone marrow. And that's going to change our whole idea of what we are as a species. We no longer will have to think that when a part of us starts to give out, that that's it. We can start to think about possibly growing our own replacement parts, and that's just astonishing.
It certainly is. Now, you said at the beginning of that thought that you thought human cloning was going to be a pretty rare occurrence if it happens. Why do you think it will be rare?
I think it's going to be very expensive, just like in vitro fertilization and other assisted fertility techniques are very expensive. But more important, I think most of us will probably want to have children with our partners. However, I think there are a few situations when cloning may seem like the best option. And in those situations, I think that there are in vitro fertilization clinics that are interested in providing this as a service. And moreover, I think when it gets provided as a service, we're going to open the door to genetic engineering, which is something that we hasn't really been feasible in the past, and it is feasible now. So if you'd like, I can tell you the situations when I think people might want to clone themselves, and then the situations when they might want to genetically engineer as well. Should I go on?
Yeah, well, when do you think people might want to clone themselves?
Okay. Well, I think that there's a couple of situations. One of them is some people, even today, have had children in order to have organ donors. Now, this is very rare, and it sounds sort of crazy, but some ethicists have said that they thought that this was not objectionable, really. The one situation in which that I wrote about, and almost everybody else did too, was a family in California named the Ayalas. And they had a teenage daughter who was dying of leukemia. The only thing that would save her was a bone marrow transplant, which meant they had to take the bone marrow from somebody else and give it to her. But unfortunately, there was nobody in her family and nobody in a huge computerized databank of potential bone marrow donors who matched closely enough to make this possible. So the mother said, I'm going to have another baby so that I can have a bone marrow donor. And the father had a vasectomy, said he wanted to do it so badly he had a vasectomy reversed. The mother was in her 40s. Somehow, miraculously, she became pregnant. There was one chance in four that the baby would be genetically close enough to match their daughter who was dying. And it worked. The baby was close enough. When she was a year old, she provided bone marrow, and she saved her older sister's life, and now the Ayalas have two children instead of none. Now, when I wrote about this for the New York Times, I asked, has this happened before? And the answer I found was, yes, it happens more often than people realize, and it also happens with kidney donors. And some families actually abort if the fetus is not of the right, is not closely related, so they couldn't use it as a donor. Now, you may say that you find this abhorrent, but the problem is that we don't really tell people that they have to give a good reason for having a baby or for having an abortion. It's really considered a private reproductive choice. If you could clone, you wouldn't have to take one chance in four of having a child that would be a close enough genetic match. You could have an identical twin. Now, the identical twin might be born years later, but who would even have to know it was a clone? I mean, just because they resemble the child 10 years later or something? But you would have somebody that would be the perfect donor, and it could be a private decision of yours. I think that that would be very tempting for some people, and I think that that's one reason it would happen.
Do you think that in the future cloning might become an option for people who have infertility problems?
I think that there's a human urge to have children that are genetically related to us. And I think that's one reason that so many people go through so many years of agony and spend so much money in vitro fertilization clinics. Now, there are many people who, for one reason or another, I'm thinking many women who, for one reason or another, don't have a partner and they would like to have children. Some of these women are reaching their 40s, let's say, or maybe even 50. And it gets increasingly difficult. Even if you say, I think I'll just take some sperm from an anonymous donor and have my own eggs fertilized, it becomes increasingly unlikely as you grow older that you'll be successful. So these days you have a choice. You can choose an egg donor, a person who's unrelated to you that you don't know, and you can choose her according to all sorts of characteristics. Is she the same ethnic group as you? What's her IQ? What were her SAT scores? You can go through a whole list of characteristics and choose what you think is the perfect egg donor. And you can do the same thing for a sperm donor. And then a fertility clinic can mix the sperm and eggs, create an embryo just for you, and you can try to become pregnant and have that baby. Now, I think that there are going to be people who would say, I would rather have a child that's genetically related to me. I would rather clone myself. And it wouldn't really be me, because after all, say I'm 50 years old, I have a clone of myself. This baby may resemble me, but she will be born 50 years later in an entirely different world. It's not really me. And anyway, isn't that my own private reproductive decision? Whose right is it to tell me whether I can have a baby or what the genetic inheritance of that baby should be? So these are some rare situations where I think some people are going to want to spend the money to clone. And I know that there are infertility clinics that will provide that service when they've had some more experience with manipulating the cells that they would have to do.
My guest is Gina Collada, author of the new book, Clone. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about cloning with New York Times science reporter Gina Collada. How does the possibility of human cloning affect the possible things we could do with genetic engineering?
What cloning does for the very first time is allows us to seriously think about doing genetic engineering of human beings. And the reason is that one of the problems with genetic engineering is how are you going to get those genes into the cells? Say you wanted to make a child that was going to be resistant to AIDS, could never develop AIDS. We know there are genes that confer resistance to HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. But how would you get them into every cell of a human being? Well, if you cloned, it's actually not that hard. For example, you could take a cell, let's take the kind of cell that everybody always wants to take, some scraping from the roof of the mouth because it's so easy to get. And you could grow it in the laboratory into huge sheets of millions of cells if you wanted them. You could have a lot of those cells. Now you could add to those cells a gene that confers resistance to AIDS. Now most of those cells, when you add genes, most cells don't take them up. So almost every cell just rejects the gene. And even those that do take up the gene don't use it. But there may be like one out of every several thousand that does take up the gene and does use it properly. Well, you don't care. You've got millions of cells. You just find the one or two or three, whatever you need, that has the gene that you wanted to add. It's inside the cell now. It's being used. You clone that cell. And now you're going to make every cell in their body has a gene that makes them resistant to AIDS. And we can think about that for a lot of genes that we're now finding with the Human Genome Project and with other research that confer resistance to diseases like, let's say, Alzheimer's disease. So we can think about doing something that's morally equivalent, I think, to vaccination. When you make somebody resistant to polio, you do it in a very different way, but the result is they can never get that disease. The questions will come in when we get more complex genes and more complicated traits.
What do you see as the real hazards, the dangers of cloning?
We actually don't know for sure, but everything we know about cloning indicates, sort of paradoxically enough, that it should be safer than normal reproduction. Now, this is going to sound weird because you've probably heard 1,000 times about all the dangers of cloning. But in fact, most of the things that go wrong and create birth defects, or more likely, embryos that just die so the woman has a miscarriage, go wrong right in the very beginning when an egg cell is starting to get itself ready to be fertilized, or a sperm cell is developing so that it can fertilize an egg. And with cloning, you avoid those steps altogether. You're starting out with genes that have already gone through that step because they come from an adult organism. So you would avoid, these common birth defects are so common that by the time you get into your 40s or so, about 90% of all fertilized eggs don't survive because they have these genetic defects. And the other thing that makes human reproduction so chancy is mutations that can occur that can be lethal or that can cause serious diseases. You don't have that problem with cloning. You're taking a cell whose genes are fine. You know that. Otherwise, that you wouldn't have even gotten that cell because that animal or that person wouldn't have survived. So you actually avoid a lot of the things that make it so chancy to reproduce the normal way.
You know, it's interesting. Ian Wilmot, one of the scientists who cloned Dolly, opposes human cloning. What are his reasons for opposing it?
Ian Wilmot's been very careful about this. He says that he finds it abhorrent and he doesn't like human cloning. When I asked him about some specific examples that were sort of along the way, he wasn't quite as adamant. For example, I asked him, suppose you were infertile and you're having a lot of trouble having embryos, and suppose you only could get one embryo, but the doctor said, let me clone this embryo, not cloning a human being, clone the embryo and make 8 or 10 instead of the one that you have, and then you'll have a better chance to become pregnant. And then if you have a few left over, we can freeze them and you can have the identical twins a few years later. Is that objectionable? And he said no, he didn't really have a problem with that. Now, that's still creating identical twins born years apart. But then you say, well, what is objectionable? And he keeps coming back to the fact that he really wants to go ahead with his research, which he and I and many others believe is going to really advance medicine in a different way, because it's not cloning humans, it's cloning animals, and it's also going to advance science. And he doesn't want people to think that he's interested in being out there saying, I'm going to clone, and that he's some sort of a madman. So I think he's been purposely cautious, scientific, and I think appropriately too, and has stayed away from things which he has no interest in doing. He's not going to clone. He doesn't work with human cells, and his work is not really directed toward that.
Gina Collada is a science reporter for the New York Times. Her new book is called Clone. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Elvin Jones, one of the most influential drummers in the history of jazz.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Drummer Elvin Jones recently celebrated his 70th birthday. His most influential work was with John Coltrane from 1960 to 66. Their Village Vanguard sessions were recently re-released in a CD box set. Jones has topped Downbeat's readers and critics polls for the past 2 years. As a recent cover story said, Jones is instantly recognizable by his rumbling feel, his free-form solos, the signature touch of his brushes, and the sheer force with which he hits the drums. Perhaps more than anyone else in the history of jazz, he's proven that the drummer can be more than just an accompanist. Jones is from one of the most celebrated jazz families. In fact, his first recording as a leader, made in 1961, featured Brother Hank at the piano and Brother Thad on cornet.
Since I was 2 years old. And I've always wanted to play drums. I've never really wanted to play another instrument. You know, we had a piano, and Hank had an older sister who played piano as well. She was a classical pianist. And Hank, you know, all the rest of it, we all, my other brothers and sisters, all, they, everybody took piano lessons, and they could do something, at least play the scales.
How did you know that it was drums for you?
Because I saw them. I used to see the circuses. Ringling Brothers, we lived in a place in Pontiac, Michigan, where right in front of our house was a huge, great open field, I guess about, you know, maybe 1,000 acres or so. And it was just where all the circuses used to come, and they passed right by our house to you know, with all the elephants and, you know, zebras and horses and all of that, camels and all these things. I just to see them when I was a little boy. And I'd see the, they would always have a circus parade, basically. And I just got fascinated with the drums, with the percussion. I'd watch the drummers, you know. They'd be dressed up in these fancy, beautiful uniforms. I thought it was similar, I guess, to the uniforms I used to wear when I started playing in a high school band. But I guess that started me off. So I was just enraptured with that. And I would follow that van for a mile or so, and just to walk next to the drummers.
You were in the marching band in school, weren't you?
Oh, yes.
Do you think that the kind of parade drumming and marching band drumming that you were so fond of as a child affected your drumming later in life?
Well, certainly I developed a good sense of time, because one had to march, and the standard tempo was 120 beats per minute, and of course that does something to you if you march for 2 or 3 miles and go out to play a football game and go through the formations making letters and whatever. And I think it certainly gives you another sense of what percussion really is all about, and how it relates and how it blends with everything else. It's just as much a part of music as any other instrument in a band.
When you started to play the drums, what did you do to strengthen your hands and to learn how to coordinate your hands and your feet?
Oh, God. Well, I didn't start using my hands and my feet that much. I started simply with a pair of drumsticks, a textbook, and a drum pad. And all together, the whole thing cost about less than $3. And it was not so easy to get $3 in those days. But I was just trying to learn the basics. I tried to learn the rudiments. I did what the assignments given to me by my teacher.
How old were you before you had an actual set of drums in your house instead of just a drum pad?
Oh, I think I was 21 years old. I had been in the Army, to the Army Air Corps, rather, and did my service. And when I got discharged, with the mustering out pay that I had, I borrowed another $35 from my oldest sister, and I bought a set of drums. That's the first set of drums I ever had. I was over almost 22 years old.
When you got out of the military, I think for a while you played in a house band in Detroit at a club where a lot of well-known musicians came, and you accompanied them.
Yes.
So that must have been a great way to get exposed to playing with a lot of people.
Yes, it was. It certainly improved my education a great deal. My main purpose was try to learn as much as I could about what the music that had fascinated me so much. Because I was in the Army, I was in the Air Corps, when I first heard organized big time, what I thought was some of the greatest music I've ever heard in my life. On a recording, I heard Dizzy Gillespie and Big Sid Catlett was the drummer, who he's just amazing, this guy. They played Dizzy's composition of Salt Peanuts. And Sid Catlett played an eight-bar introduction. And it was with brushes. And I never heard anything so beautiful, so precise, so musical that I was completely enraptured by that. And so from that point on, I've listened to every record that I could possibly get. You know, there weren't many records floating around in barracks in those days, and they're all. And even if they were, it was not so easy to find a record player to play them on. We had one, and the needles were all dull. But we managed to listen to it anyway. But I thought that was just fascinating. I was just fascinated. I've been fascinated from that point on. I've never lost that enthusiasm. I think it's just the most beautiful thing I'd ever heard in my life.
My guest is drummer Elvin Jones. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with drummer Elvin Jones. Now, I know you auditioned for Benny Goodman's band, and I'm thinking how jazz history would have been changed if you ended up playing with Goodman and going in that direction when you were a young man. He didn't hire you. I guess he had his reasons.
Well, I had this audition, and I think, it was mainly instigated by my brother Hank, because he was playing with Benny Goodman, and they had Benny had made this movie, the Benny Goodman story.
With Steve Allen as Benny Goodman.
So the Benny had reactivated his big band, and Hank was a prominent part of that because Teddy Wilson didn't. They were going to just reform the band and go on a world tour to promote the film. So my brother, I think, was played. he was dabbled in a little nepotism at that time to get me to come to New York and maybe be a part of that band. So anyway, I didn't pass I didn't make the audition, and I didn't really feel so bad after I found out that they had been auditioning drummers for about a week before I got there. And just the day before, one of the drummers that I really admire, Shadow Wilson, he didn't pass the audition either. So I didn't feel so bad about that then.
How did you end up playing with John Coltrane in the early 60s? When you first started playing with him in the early 60s?
Well, before that, when I lived on East 6th Street, right off 2nd Avenue, and on 4th Street and the Bowery, it was this club, the Five Spot, one of the first Five Spot. And there I met Thelonious Monk, who was playing there every night with John Coltrane and with Shadow Wilson, and Wilbur Ware was the bass player. And I used to sit there every night with hold a glass of beer for 3-4 hours and listen to that music. And anyway, that's how I first I met John Coltrane there. And then later he started to play with Miles Davis band, and then I had occasion to substitute for Philly Joe Jones once or twice. And during this time, John was thinking about forming his own group, and he asked me if and when this happened, would I consent to play with him? And I told him I certainly would, and he only had to, when the time came, all he had to do was ask me.
Since the Village Vanguard recordings that you made with John Coltrane in 1961 have just been reissued, why don't I play something from that? I think we'll hear Spiritual, which is a Coltrane piece inspired, I believe, by a spiritual.
I grew up in the church, and my father was a deacon.
In the Baptist church?
In the Baptist church. And I think John Coltrane's grandfather and mother, he grew up in almost the same kind of atmosphere that I did. And so spiritual is something that is very deeply ingrained in our character. And spiritual to me brings memories of my father on Wednesday night and on the Wednesdays prayer meetings we used to have in church, and where he would get down on his knees and pray for hours. And you could feel, even if you couldn't hear or understand all of the words that he was saying, you could certainly feel it. And that's what, when John Coltrane played a song, Spiritual, then that's the kind of feeling that he invoked in me, and I suppose a lot of people who heard it or who had the experience enough to understand what it was he was saying.
Thank you.
Coltrane with my guest Elvin Jones on drums, recorded in 1961. Live at the Village Vanguard, a session just reissued. I'm wondering if your drumming in the opening of Spiritual, as recorded at the Vanguard, was composed before, you know, was thought out beforehand, or if this is improvised?
It was all improvised. We never had a rehearsal in the whole time that we were together. Not one time. Everything was improvised. As a matter of fact, I never really knew until I heard a downbeat exactly what it was we were going to play. It was sort of like that. You know, once you started to play it, and we just sort of fell, sort of rallied around the flag. And it came off like that. I don't, it's very unique. I never had that kind of experience ever before or since.
Did you ever say to him, I want to know more before we start?
No, I would. I didn't have that much. I couldn't. He was a band leader. I thought he could play anything he wanted, and I knew he was capable of playing anything. You know, he could play the New York Philharmonic if he wanted to. You know, he had that kind of discipline. You know, he was disciplined as well as any other musician I've ever seen. You know, in any kind of orchestra or whatever. And so he knew exactly. John always knew what he was doing, and he had confidence enough in the rest of us that we would be able to complement and enhance and form and make it into something that was tangible.
Now, you've said that the band would never rehearse. I imagine you didn't see any charts or sheet music before playing. Is that right?
No.
No,
it was all in our head, all in our minds.
Would John Coltrane talk with you about the pieces? Like, for instance, he had a composition, Alabama, that he said was inspired by the tragedy when a church in Alabama was bombed, and I think it was four girls were killed.
Yeah, well,
did he talk with you about that before the piece, or did you know that the piece was inspired by?
No, he didn't say anything about it. Yeah, that I think what you're referring to liner notes. I think somebody he made that was an afterthought.
That was an afterthought.
At least, as far as the general public is concerned, I don't know what he thought in his own mind. I know what I thought in my own mind, and I thought that melody sort of illustrated a lot of the things that a lot of people were feeling. And it gave us when I was playing that piece, the tears were coming from my eyes. Everybody in that group had, including Coltrane, it was very sad.
We'll talk more with drummer Elvin Jones after a break. This is Fresh Air. back with drummer Elvin Jones. When John Coltrane's solos got longer, and then your solos got longer too, I wonder what it was like to accompany him in, like, what, 40-minute solos? I mean, that's about the length of a whole set.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, there was one occasion in Philadelphia, where you are now. you remember the Showboat Lounge?
Yeah, that was a jazz club before I moved here, yeah.
Anyway, we used to play there quite often in Pep's Bar and all, and the Blue Note up in North Philly. But we used to play, you know, the routine was on Saturday or Sunday afternoon. It would be a matinee, and we played a matinee that this particular matinee. John was playing a very fast tempo piece, and something happened to his horn. I guess pad fell out or whatever, you know, and it was just all he could barely get a tone out. It was just squeaks and squawks. So, and he wouldn't stop. And so he played until he finally started making scales out of all of these sounds that were coming out of his horn. And he played this piece for 3 hours. But the thing about it is, when we finished, I was ready to play the next piece. I said, okay, what are we going to play next? And the matinee was over, you know. So you're talking about 40 minutes was not. I thought the way that group was, I think it was, the time didn't really have any significance. You know, I didn't get tired. Nobody got tired. It was just to pursue an idea or a mode to its natural conclusion. And if it took an hour or 40 minutes or 2 hours or whatever, then that, so be it.
What about when the music of the group started moving away from time signatures and getting freer? As the drummer, how did you feel about that?
Well, just like anything else, I don't think any. It really didn't matter, because that's what you refer to as an abstract, and so it was nothing strange about being about abstracts, because I used to like to watch. Go to a museum in Detroit. You got a lot of Jackson Pollock's paintings, you know, and Matisse and Picasso and all these guys. That's all abstract, you know. I didn't think it was any different than anything else. It's just a musical abstract. But the portrait is there, nevertheless.
What were your brothers, Hank Jones and Thad Jones, reactions to your work with Coltrane? Did they think it was getting too far out? Did they like it?
I guess so. I don't know. I know Thad, they liked me. You know, that's the main thing. They didn't care what I played. I'm the baby boy.
So did you not even know what they thought of the music?
No, I never. They always knew I could play very well, and I knew I was a good drummer, and they told me that many times.
Elvin Jones. His Village Vanguard sessions with John Coltrane were recently released as a CD box set. Jones now records for the Enja label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Roberta Shurrock, and Alan Tu, with Monique Nazareth, Kathy Wolf, and Joan Tui Westman. Research assistance from Sarah Scher. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
100 years ago, the five boroughs of New York united as New York City. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Robert Caro, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Robert Moses, the man who built the bridges, highways, and parks that define the city. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.